Well, very excited to reach the final stages of the book tonight. And if you're able to follow along via the recordings or live with our previous sessions, you kind of know where we've been. If this is your first time tuning in, no worries at all. We will kind of treat each section mostly as a standalone. You know, the book builds on itself, but you can go through them in any order. So do feel free to go back if you haven't seen the previous sessions or if you haven't gone through the whole book yet. Feel free anytime. You've got the audio book. You should have a hard copy of the book. And then you've got the book study. If you're looking for the previous sessions, they are under Instructional Leadership Show. That's where we've been posting them, and you should find them in your emails as well. But we're going to cover chapters 16 through 21 tonight. And some of these chapters are pretty short. Heather, you've probably seen that I had very little to say about maybe chapters like 19 and 20. So we should have some good time for discussion there.
Perfect.
You're taking 16 and 17 today, is that right?
That sounds great. Yes.
Good deal. If that's not what we said before, let me know. That's fine.
will let you know
I was
that's what we
changing it
said
on you. That
before.
was unintentional. That's not what I meant to say.
No worries. The
The
first two. That's what
first
I'm
two,
going to
yes. Good deal. All right. And I have an email going out. Let me see if I can tell if that has gone out yet. Don't actually know because I'm not sure I sent it to myself. So
It
anybody get
went
the
out.
email? You got it? The
It
last
went
one
out
just like 5 minutes ago.
about 2 or 3, 4 minutes ago.
Okay, perfect. Good deal. All right. Good deal. Well, it looks like we've got our group here. Then, oh, I'll continue to let people in after I kick things off. But all right, we'll go ahead and officially hit start here. Welcome, Susan. Thanks so much for being here. All right. Welcome, everyone, to week four of our Now We're Talking book study. I'm your host, Justin Bader, and we are here to talk about chapters 16 through 21 of the book. And my co-author, Heather Bell Williams, is joining us again tonight, and she'll take the first couple of chapters. So, welcome, everyone. And Heather, please go ahead and take it away.
All right. I'm eager to hear in the chat, if you will, as we go along, to talk a little bit about how things have been going in the last couple of weeks. I was away last week. So how are your classroom visits going in terms of consistency, and what challenges are you facing? So if you can throw those questions or answers to those questions into the chat, Justin will keep an eye on that, and we'd love to have some time for discussing some of those barriers and some of the issues that are coming up and how your conversations are going. So I think I jumped ahead there, Justin, but to take a look at where we're headed tonight, we're looking at chapter 16, building your feedback repertoire. We're looking at chapter 17, balancing your formal evaluation responsibilities, recognizing that that's different than doing walkthroughs all the time. Chapter 18, identifying improvements from those classroom visits. Chapter 19, opening the door to new models of professional learning. Chapter 20, choosing that instructional focus for an observation cycle, and scaling classroom visits across your school and district. And so trying to expand that a little bit. So that's where we're headed tonight. And like Justin said, I'll start with chapter 16. We're looking in chapter 16 at building your feedback repertoire. So you're getting into classrooms, you're making some of those observational notes, evidence-based notes, and you're having those conversations, maybe face to face, maybe email. Maybe that's a tricky spot for you and you're just trying to figure that part out. But we really want to get into that idea of having a repertoire of feedback, phraseology and wording and shared language that everybody agrees on and that you're able to come back to again and again. It makes it so much easier. You're making your workload lighter every time you commit to memory or use again your feedback language. So some of the tips that we have in chapter 16, writing high quality feedback, learning the vocabulary of your curriculum. So learning the words that your curriculum developers use when they're talking about implementation, keeping your feedback repertoire accessible with some kind of phrase database. We'll talk a little bit about that more in a second. Structuring your thinking with templates. I've just been completing my third round of observations. We start a lot later than a lot of you folks. And so as I started to give feedback, the first couple of rounds were just those quick rounds and didn't include a lot of feedback or any feedback. But as I started to do the third round, I wanted some templates. And so it became much easier and faster to generate that individual feedback using a template. We want to build trust with consistency, not with that canned feedback. You never want your templates or your feedback to feel canned, or that it's just something that you're giving the same feedback to everybody, because they will know and staff will compare feedback. And so you want to make sure that you're not just regurgitating exactly what you said to a whole group of staff. Notice and document what matters most, using your feedback repertoire in conversation. And also the action challenge at the end of this chapter is finding that reusable language, being able to come up with some sort of system for keeping that repertoire of feedback. So I see Shanita in the comments, hasn't been able to start yet. Teachers being out has been a big obstacle along with a few other things. Absolutely, I ran into that this week. I had my rotation set, and one of the teachers in that rotation was absent that day. And so, you know, it gets tricky, but once you get into the swing of it, you'll find that you can sort of go somewhere else and then come back to that person. Learning the language for your feedback is so critical. And I love this image of visiting another country and Paris and the idea of a different language. And until we have a common language, and until you learn the language of your shared expectations or of your feedback documents, you are gonna, you're in for miscommunication, misinterpretation, all kinds of maybe tears. One of the first times I gave some feedback based on a framework that we were using, the teacher cried. And not to belittle that, I mean, that was obviously very, very difficult for her. And obviously I was not in the groove yet, but we need to learn the language of those instructional frameworks that we're using. Inez, I've gotten into several classrooms. I've emailed teachers using the 10 questions for better feedback. Teachers reflected on their teaching and even commented on areas they wanted to improve their craft. That's awesome. That's perfect. That's the kinds of things that you're getting right into. So reflected on their and even commented on areas they wanted to improve. And that's when it really gets exciting. You get that back and forth, the conversation between you and the teachers that you're working with. Way to go. That's great. That shared language to avoid miscommunication and misconceptions. There are tons of sources for this. And I know it's a little bit at the very beginning when Justin first started chatting with me about this idea of finding shared language, I wasn't 100% sure that I understood. And as we talked about it more, I discovered that there was indeed a ton of shared language that I had out there at my disposal. And so in our school district, we use the Danielson framework. Some of you probably use Marzano, Kim Marshall's work, the Strung framework. You would have state or district evaluation criteria for teachers. You have school-based and curriculum-based expectations. Most of your core subject areas will have curriculum-based expectations about what it's like to teach math to grade 10 students and what those expectations are for teachers. So there are lots and lots of sources, and we'll continue to talk about that. That'll be a recurring theme over tonight. The more you use it, the more familiar it will become. And this, of course, is as graphic if you're familiar with the Danielson framework. So this is from her 2013 edition, but you can see that there's just such a huge, huge body of information in terms of those four domains and all of the different subdomains and subcomponents. And so one of the ways that you can sort of make things more streamlined and make it much smoother is to start to figure out a source to store your repertoire of feedback phrases. So instead of having to memorize everything from, say, domain two there, the classroom environment, and I would have, because I've used it for years and years and years, And even before I was doing this kind of feedback with teachers, I was doing a lot of evaluations using the framework. So certainly things that are proficient for sure, I do have some of those phrases in my memory, but that came after a lot of years and a lot of work. So one of the ways that we're suggesting that you are able to make better use of your time and make, you know, reuse the same feedback is getting in more repetition. So the more you use shared language, just like the more you do your exercises at the gym, the more it becomes second nature and the easier it becomes. So you want to be using that shared language from Marzano, from Danielson framework, from your curriculum documents. You want to use it in your observation notes when you're summarizing or making notes for yourself or for the teacher. You want to use that language in your notes, in the written feedback that you give to the teachers. You want to use that language in the conversations. You'll find yourself, you write it for quite a while, you use it a lot, and then all of a sudden you'll find yourself when you're talking face to face for a conversation, you'll feel some of that coming out. Meetings and committees, your communications, your PD, things that you're doing with your staff, the more you can use that common shared language, the more familiar everybody can get with it. So some of the other sources for the framework language, we mentioned the teacher evaluation criteria and standards, your state or provincial priority documents. Right now, because of COVID, our province has a priority math curriculum and a priority language arts curriculum. And so those priority documents are very succinct in terms of this is what needs to get done this year because of the some of the lags and interruptions to learning. District division office initiatives, curricular programs, maybe there's an initiative in your district, maybe that you're working on a particular program. A lot of districts are looking at social emotional learning programs in this particular context, specific trainings, PD, and then there can be school developed and team or department developed frameworks for shared language. And Justin and I are just finishing up a book on this very topic, those last two bullets. And so that idea of creating your school-based or your team-based instructional frameworks based on initiatives and things that are going on for school improvement. So there's lots of sources for that language. So we'd invite you to think about what are some specific types of precise language that you could use more often? Because again, as I said before, the more often you use it, the easier it will become and the more it'll flow a little bit more easily and it won't sound stilted or feel strange or weird. And so we'd invite you, if you can think of some, to put them in the chat, some specific types of precise language you could use or specific settings or contexts where you could use that language. So just as we continue, maybe you could answer that question in the chat. Please and thank you.
Yeah. And I'll chime in there. This came up in our Adelaide group. People were wondering, like, can I use shared language that hasn't really been adopted officially by my district? And I'm curious what people's thoughts are on that, because I think it's a good question. And certainly we want to be very careful if we're anything that's actually part of the evaluation. But you've got a lot of possible sources out there. You know, you might be a Danielson framework and you might say, hey, I actually want to look at the Marzano framework or vice versa. So thoughts on using different sources, what might be useful in a particular context? Love to hear people's thoughts on that.
Again, just a little bit of feedback and some frozen screens there, but I think we're back. I think we're good.
Yeah, I froze there. Sorry. All right, well, we'll keep an eye on the chat there, but shall we proceed then, Heather?
That's sure. Sounds good.
All right, good deal.
So I mentioned earlier, one of the really, really awesome apps or projects that Justin and his team have been working on over several years now, is the idea of the Repertoire app. And if you haven't checked it out, you really should give it a go and have a look at it, because you can import whatever the language of your framework. So in my case, we're using the Danielson framework. So you can import that right into Repertoire. Actually, you don't have to do that. Justin's team will do that for you. And if you have a different framework that might not be as well known, you can give that to them and they will import that into Repertoire for you. And then when you're in the classroom, I use an iPad and I use the Repertoire app right on the iPad. And so it cuts down on so much time because I don't have to take notes and then send feedback after I leave the classroom. I'm taking notes and generating the feedback all at the same time in Repertoire. And so this is just a sample, a screenshot of the kinds of things that you can do with Repertoire. But I love the snippet feature. So as soon as I type anything in that snippet entry box, so in this case, on the example, you see that the beginning APST, and then because if you've used it before, anytime that you've used that word or those letters before, it will become predictive for you. It will generate all of the snippets that you've previously saved. So you just type in the snippet box, you press enter, the phrase is added to the message, and then it's also saved to the database. So if you're new to it and you're just starting to make some of your phrases and some of your framework language, it's saved for later. But all of the, for in my case, the Danielson framework language is all saved to Repertoire. And so it's great. I just have to type in, you know, you can see again, there's an example there, the beginning of the word focus. And you see that before you had typed students were on task and focused, you hit enter and that's in the message to the teacher. Then it generates an email. And so it works through your work email and you can just generate an email and copy yourself in and your vice principal or whomever that works for. So a really great tool. Using the shared language offline when you're not using your app or your iPad, you wanna make sure that you keep your hard copy and your PDF handy. Use it in writing, use it in conversation. I actually took the Danielson framework and sort of chopped it up into long, skinny columns and just have a big binder clip on it. And I often carry it around with me when I'm going to classrooms to do observations. That and the combination of Repertoire give me the language that I need quickly. And it's become much, much smoother and faster. In terms of discussion, what shared language would you use in Repertoire? If you were going to use that Repertoire app, maybe you already are, what's the shared language that you would want imported into that? And what shared language could you use offline? What would be the kinds of things that you might carry around with you or have at your disposal for those face-to-face or written conversations? And again, perhaps we can, I don't know, Justin, how we're doing time-wise. Maybe we just want them to type that in the chat and we'll keep going, or what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I'd love to hear from a couple of people. So if you wouldn't mind typing in the chat, or if you want to unmute, feel free. But yeah, I think you made a really good point there that it becomes predictive. I love that phrase. We've never used that one, but that's exactly it, right? That it starts to kind of know what you're about to say, so that you don't have to, you know, type everything out. And I think that's what allows it to be personal language, right? It sounds like you, because it's your words, it's just easier to reuse them. So if you tend to, you know, use certain language to describe something, you know, you can be precise the first time you type it. And then after that, you can simply kind of repeat. So you're building that language bank or that repertoire. So that's why it's called that. Hope you like the app. Hope you make good use of it. It's included with your membership, so you don't have to buy it separately. And one thing that is also an option within your admin team, if you would like to share an account, that works really well, because then you're all working from the same phrase database. So anybody on your team can do an observation. It's still going to come from your email, you know, because that's comes out of your email account. But then you can have everything in one account if you'd like. So anytime, please reach out to our team. We're happy to get you set up. Send us your staff roster. We'll import them. We'll import your framework language, And if you don't have it ready to go, if you're not quite sure, happy to chat and figure out what that might be. Any district initiatives, if you want to use that feedback, maybe you'll go to a meeting next month and they'll give you a big PDF full of, of rubrics and things. So we're always happy to strategize on what would be helpful language to put at your fingertips. And Heather, you're saying you actually cut up the physical rubrics and like stapled them together in like strips. Is that right?
I did. I took a hard copy of the Danielson framework, because that's the one we use in our district, and I chopped up all the distinguished columns, and I just put them in order, put a big binder clip on them, proficient, same thing, so that the language was right there and I could easily, so I use it when I'm doing walkthroughs, and I also use it when I'm generating language for a formal evaluation.
Nice. I love it. Yeah, so. I know you told me that before, but I hadn't really caught the format there. Yeah, do what works for you. I love it.
Yeah, very, very low tech paper cutter, chopped it all up.
Good deal.
All righty. So we're taking a look now at chapter 17, and we were just chatting a little bit about, you know, the idea of you have those formal evaluation responsibilities too. And so in terms of your time and your time management and just the benefits of walkthroughs, you want to make sure that you're getting into classrooms and doing those shorter observations and doing lots of feedback. But we recognize that you have to balance that with your formal evaluation responsibilities. And depending on your district and your school, that might look a little different for each of you. But again, in chapter 17, the tips that we have there are consider that everything's fair game, and that idea of don't ever say to your staff, oh, this walkthrough stuff, it's not evaluative. Don't worry, it's not evaluative. It's not meant to be evaluative in its very intrinsic nature, but you have to recognize that everything that you see someone doing really does stay in your head, and it does become evaluative. It can become part of the evaluation that you're doing for someone. So we would just advise against that idea of just doing this blanket statement, no, don't worry about walkthroughs because it's not evaluative. You know in your heart that reasonably everything that you see someone do can become evaluative. So just stay away from those kind of blanket statements. Remember your contractual restrictions on those informal observations. So depending on your teacher's collective agreement, there may be restrictions on who can do informal observations, how many can you do them, those kinds of things. So, you know, keep that in mind. And we're going to talk a lot about differentiating high stakes teacher evaluation and lower stakes teacher evaluation, and then allocate your formal evaluation time using an 80-20 rule between your high stakes and low stakes. And we will talk about that in a second. Close those high stakes evidence gaps. Make sure you've got lots of evidence for those evaluations. And I love this strategy. So learning the claim evidence interpretation judgment format for writing rock solid evaluations. I first learned this tool for writing, I think it was reference letters, Justin. I'm not sure. I think that's what we talked about first a few years ago, but I love this tool. And then our action challenge at the end of chapter 17 will be identifying the high stakes teachers, the ones that you need to spend that 80% of your evaluation time with. Perhaps you don't need to do formal evaluations. Justin and I were chatting with some teachers in Australia, and they just said, no, we don't do formal evaluations. And we were like, oh, that's interesting. So if you don't do formal evaluations, think in terms still of uncertainty and risk of the problems arising. So in terms of if you're not in classrooms, if you're not, maybe you don't need to do the formal evaluations, but if you're not in there doing those observations, think in terms of what kinds of problems could arise. And if you've been in the principalship or in school leadership very long, you can probably think of times when the parents knew before you as the principal or AP knew about a problem. And you don't want to be surprised. You always want to be a step ahead and to have that sense of what's going on in your classrooms before someone from the outside brings it to your attention. And we've probably, I think, Justin, both you and I have some embarrassing stories of times that we didn't realize what really was going on, and parents or someone else, a member of the public, brought it to our attention. And so you really want to get in there and know what's going on and balance those risks. So what are some, again, we'll invite you, we'll keep going and we'll invite you to put this in the chat. What are some of the uncertainties and risks that you face related to teacher performance in your context? What might be some of those risks that you face related to teacher performance.
Yeah, and Heather, I'll jump in on that one. I feel like, I probably need to give those being caught off guard by parents moments a little bit of credit for how strongly I feel about getting into classrooms, because, you know, there's nothing like not knowing what to say to a parent who says, here's what it's like in my kid's classroom, to get you permanently motivated to get into classrooms. I think most of us have been there to some extent. And the more we're in classrooms, the less likely we are to be in that situation. Like I just will never forget. Remember, I can still picture that conversation where it's like, no, I don't actually know what you're talking about. And then remembering, or, you know, thinking to myself, I don't ever want to be in this situation again. So I want to know what's going on in classrooms. I want to know much more than any parent about what's going on in classrooms. And I have never regretted that effort, that awareness.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. We want to avoid those situations for sure. One of the things, the terminology that we're going to use in chapter 17 is using that idea of a working hypothesis. And so taking that whole picture of all of the teachers for whom you need to do teacher evaluations, or your entire staff, given that you want to eliminate or diffuse any risk of not knowing what's really going on. And we're going to talk about an idea of developing a working hypothesis such that you're able to put those teachers, one analogy is in buckets in terms of performance, but that idea of using your evaluation time, clumping the teachers together so that you're able to do similar evaluations for teachers that share certain aspects of their performance. And so we're going to take a look at that in a little bit more depth. That idea of using hypothesis, isolating, support this judgment, and then revise it as you learn more. So you're taking that idea of, I think this is how this is going to be. Could it be that this group of teachers or this teacher is performing in this way in a particular area? Then ask, do I have evidence to support this judgment I'm making? And then revise it as I'm in and out of classrooms even more. So you're starting with that hypothesis and then moving forward. And this is the bucket analogy, sort of your hunches in terms of buckets of similar teachers. So if you have 30 teachers on your staff, you can start to divide them up into buckets of similar teachers, and perhaps there's a group that are similar in terms of classroom management. Maybe they're really great at classroom management. In a given domain, teachers fall into those certain buckets. And as Justin has here, classroom management, you know, maybe there's a group that are really warm. Maybe there's a group that are looser in their classroom management, or another group that's super strict, or that has student-directed classroom management down pat. And so you can divide teachers into certain categories together, and you would mentally lump them together, and then you decide which domains you're going to address in the evaluation process, and decide on those initial buckets. So if you have four or five teachers out of the 30 that you would categorize as having warm classroom management, you're not going to write four or five different descriptions of warm classroom management on teacher evaluations. You're going to reuse the language when you're making the same claim about multiple teachers. So again, I think we'll keep going, but we'd love to hear from you in the chat. What would be some of your teacher buckets for what areas of practice that if you started to take your entire staff and divide them into sort of groups, what might be your area of practice? Would it be instruction or management or some other particular area of practice? And what might be some of the teacher buckets in that particular area?
Heather, I wanted to ask if I could, if you have noticed any of those buckets kind of clustering by grade level as well, because I felt like, and I don't know what the reason for that was, but I felt like I had similar classroom management styles across grade levels in a lot of cases and similar approaches. And I think that was probably the result of just years and years of teamwork and, I don't know, people, birds of a feather flocking together to some extent, but I don't know. Have you seen that?
I actually, that's an interesting question. And as I reflect on it just now, I would say yes, particularly, I'm in a K to five school. So particularly in primary, in that K to two, and it might be that they're similar age kids, those kinds of things. And they've been in the school for a really long time and they've worked together on a team. So birds of a feather, they've rubbed off on one another. And so when somebody has a good strategy, they're sharing it at their team meetings, and they're working smart in terms of combining their efforts. But absolutely, probably comes around with similar age kids and similar curricular expectations. You might end up with similar buckets, but that's an interesting observation.
Yeah, Eric is mentioning having large numbers of teachers who are alternative pathway certified, career switchers, emergency licensure, provisional licensure, and that can show up in different ways in classroom management. If you have people who've never worked with kids before, maybe they come from the corporate world, they may face similar prior life experience and a similar kind of approach toward kids and may need to be worked with in a in a particular kind of way. So I think there's like the, how can I reuse my writing if it applies to multiple teachers question, the kind of a time savings question, but also a, how can we meet multiple people's needs at once rather than treat everybody as completely unique, which everybody is completely unique. But when you break it down into specific areas of the evaluation, fortunately people have many things in common and we can address certain things together. So if you need to pull a few people into a PD session or access some training for people, a group of people who are struggling with the same thing, it's seeing those common patterns that that really can bring some efficiency and some some opportunities for people to work together and get better. And I think when it comes to the unfairness of lumping people together, one of the things that keeps it from being just what's distinguishing what we're saying here from being just lazy and copy and pasting is that the evidence is unique, right? We're not just saying give everybody the same evaluation, and do as little work as possible. We're saying like if what you're claiming about their practice is legitimately the same, then reuse your writing, but update the evidence and make that specific to each person. And then Shanita says, classroom management, lesson organization, lesson presentation style. Yeah, there are some common themes, especially when you have new people coming in. People
Forward
tend to
the
face
slides
common
and see how we
issues
do.
at the beginning of their careers. I don't know if I was if my internet was cutting out there for a second, but
Yeah, it
all
was,
right, we'll go
but
ahead here.
for
Thank you.
sure. We have some risks. We talked a little bit earlier about the risks idea, and risks, teaching quality, employability behaviors, parent satisfaction, relationships with students, student learning progress, curriculum program quality. All of those are risks of not being as out there and of doing regular observations, those kinds of things. I just had a brainwave about the bucket question that we were talking about before. And Justin, you were mentioning if you have a group of teachers who are all struggling with a particular piece, perhaps in management, and one of the comments says, with the bucket question, I think management is a common bucket. And I would agree, I think that's a really common spot where you would see, clumps of people that you could work together on a common piece or a common area. But interestingly enough, I've experienced with that group of teachers that have been working together for a really long time, there's a couple that I can clump together who are super capable, and they then can provide the PD for the aren't capable in this area. And the growth and support their colleagues in that way. So I mentioned the time savings. So this is the 80-20 approach. So 80% of your teachers are what we would call low risk, so low stakes. These teachers are generally proficient, they're doing well. And so only spend 20% of your formal evaluation time and effort on this group. Conversely, 20% of your teachers are high risk. So you're wanting to spend 80% of your efforts on them. We have a breakdown coming up of the math here. So if you have 20 teachers on your staff, if those percentages hold true, you have 16 who are low risk and probably around 4 who are high risk. If you have 100 total hours of working with teachers one-on-one, you're going to spend 20 hours for those 16 low-risk teachers, which averages out to about an hour and a quarter per teacher. You're going to spend a huge chunk. You're going to spend 80 total hours for those 4 high-risk teachers, 20 hours per teacher. It's worth the investment, right? You've got those teachers that are doing really well. You can use common language and some of the same claims about their performance, as we'll see in that particular approach where you're looking at claims and evidence. So this is the method, I guess, or the strategy that I mentioned earlier that I learned first for doing reference letters, but absolutely love it. And it's CEIJ, and it's claim, evidence, interpretation, and judgment. And it comes from a book there. You can see how to make supervision and evaluation really work. And so that idea of using these 4 pieces to be concise and specific and draw judgments based on what you're seeing as evidence. So the claim, a summary statement describing the teacher's typical practice in a given area. So a key phrase you're going to use in the claim, Mrs. Williams' work is characterized by. And so some things that you're going to want to consider when you're making this claim, is this just one isolated incident? Is it by chance, one bad day, one exceptionally really great, well-planned lesson? Or is this typical of the teacher's practice? We're wanting it to be typical. You know, a key phrase, like I said, is characterized by. So we want that to be a summary of what's typical of the teacher's practice. Then we're moving into the idea of the evidence with multiple specific documented incidents. So this is where it's different. The claim might be the same, that your classroom practice is exemplary, but the evidence is going to be specific to the individual. You've been in classrooms lots, so you're going to have lots of documented incidences and evidence. And your key phrase here is, for example, on this date, this happened. And so your evidence is laid out. You want to make sure you have multiple pieces of evidence to back up your claim. And if some of that evidence is informal or hearsay or a little bit maybe leaning toward the gossipy side of things, you need to make sure that you've got firsthand evidence that supports or refutes whatever your claim is. So you've got your claim. Now you've got your evidence where you've given documented incidents. Now you can make an interpretation. And the key phrase here is as a result. So I've made my claim. I've documented my evidence as a result, and this is your clear articulation of the consequences of the typical practice, perhaps on student learning, maybe on school culture or other relevant outcomes. Some considerations there at the bottom. Am I being arbitrary? Does this really matter? Is this a pet peeve of mine, or is it really important? Can the teacher be successful without doing what I think is best? And what are the consequences, bottom line, for student learning? Do the consequences for student learning flow directly from the teacher's practice? So really important to make sure that you're being objective and that this really matters. And the last piece of that is the judgment, the J. And your key phrase, therefore, Mrs. Williams' practice in domain 4 is best described as a level, and you're going to make that judgment. The final rating of that overall practice in a specific area, using the language and the scale of the evaluation framework, whatever you've decided. So this is your specific rating. If I'm not sure, now I know where I need to go to get, or where I need more evidence. And if I don't gather more evidence, the default would need to be satisfactory. So that's a whirlwind tour through those 4 pieces of that process. When you want to pinpoint the problem, you're going to start with your hunch, and we're recommending writing an emotional first draft of the problem. What's bothering you and why? So this is like when you're writing that report card that you're never ever going to show to anybody. When you're really upset with a child, this is the idea. You're going to write your emotional first draft, then you're going to gather more evidence. And we would suggest a strategy, the 5 whys, to uncover the root problem. And then translating that emotional first draft that you would never ever share with anybody into professional language, and deciding what evaluation criteria addresses the concerns in a professional way. So your emotional first draft here. Mr. Johnson's class is incredibly boring. He just lectures all the time. The stronger students make notes and do well in tests, but too many students fail or get bad grades because they don't have the study skills or motivation to succeed in this kind of class. He blames them for not being interested in his boring lessons and resists ways to update his teaching. That's my emotional first draft. I'm not going to show that to anybody. But then what I'm going to do with that is construct that CEIJ argument with a claim. Mr. Johnson's instruction is characterized by, and so I'm making the claim that I'm stating the evidence. For example, going back, I've made the claim, the evidence is backing up the claim. I'm interpreting it as a result of his heavy reliance on lecture. Students do this, 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 and this. And therefore, judgment, Mr. Johnson's practice in domain one is best rated as level one unsatisfactory. And so this is obviously based on the Danielson framework. So if you're not familiar with that, that's where this is coming from. But that idea of the claim, the evidence, the interpretation, and the judgment. And you can then use the CEIJ for improvement plans. That idea of, you know, Mr. Johnson obviously has some improvement to work on. And so we can use the CEIJ for improvement plans. And Justin's referencing episode 92 of the Instructional Leadership Show, where he talks about developing employee improvement plans.
Yeah, and I'll just say, if anybody is working on that currently, if you, I'm not sure if you can hear me now because my internet is not great, but if you are working on improvement plans, let me know. Happy to chat about those.
Again, this is another way that another tool at the Principal Center that you can use to start to, you know, make those decide on what pieces of practice you're going to be evaluating and then make those bucket groups. And you can see the classroom management there in the center column that we talked about before. And you can start to collect your evidence to support those claims. So don't defer judgment until the end of the year. Be honest with yourself about your current assessment of teacher practice, develop those working hypotheses, and then articulate with CEIJ. Keep updating your working hypothesis as you gather new evidence and start using that spreadsheet that was on the previous slide so that you can get it organized and you'll save yourself a ton of time. Addressing problems with CEIJ, what claim could I make? Again, that review of the blunt emotional first draft, revising to professional language, finding the evidence, how it's impacting students, and your takeaway, your judgment. And again, the positive uses of CEIJ, you could use it for a letter of commendation or a reference letter, a nomination for a particular award, perhaps for an article that you're writing or for a very positive rating and evaluation. Tons of uses for this particular strategy. Very, very practical.
Yeah, Heather, that's interesting that your first use of CEIJ, you said, was for a recommendation letter. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. It was. Yeah. The person was blown away. They were like, wow, that's like so thorough. Yeah, well, I stole it from Justin.
Well, and I stole it from John Safier. This is actually kind of a funny story. So if you Google CEIJ, you will not find much about John Safier because his book was written, you know, basically before the internet was a very big thing. It was written in 1992. And Kim Marshall emailed me like after my book was published, and he was like, you know, this was from John Safier. And I was like, oh, no, I did not. Thank you for telling me. So hopefully the later printings of the book give John credit. And I try to give John credit anytime possible, not direct plagiarism, but it's just one of those things that circulates, you know, like your district might talk about CEIJ sometimes without crediting. I mean, that's what happened in my district. People use CEIJ all the time and I didn't know where it came from, but now we know. And I just am a huge fan. I think it's just an incredible format for really making good arguments in writing. And of course, like I think with the working hypothesis idea, you're keeping that working hypothesis in your head, but you're not slapping it down on the table after every walkthrough, right? You're not saying, here, you're terrible, you know, here's the evidence. Like, this is something that we are building over time to clarify our own interpretation, kind of where someone is, right? And we're interrogating that, we're being open-minded about, you know, where is the evidence leading, and revising those hypotheses so that if they are, you know, if new information comes in, it turns out actually, you know, and I think we can probably all think of times when our hypotheses turned out to be wrong, but it was good that we made them, right? Like scientists are not upset if the way an experiment turns out is a surprise, right? You learn something, whether you're right or whether you're wrong. So like, don't be afraid to be, you know, to form a hypothesis and then be wrong. You know, I think we've just got to be willing to revise claim, evidence, interpretation. Yeah. Or impact. Yeah. Impact, like impact on students. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Kristen. Is my audio holding up okay? Let me know if it's choppy.
You're doing okay now.
Getting in and out. All right. All right. Well, I'm glad we were able to spend most of our time on 16 and 17, because 18,
that's
19,
a lot of talking. Sorry.
20, no. These, you know, are fairly straightforward, and I don't want to, you know, to overcomplicate things. But I'm excited to get to the end of the book, because this is where we start to kind of bring things together. And I feel very strongly that the purpose of classroom walkthroughs is not just to fix individual moments of teaching. You know, not just to say, oh, you could have done this, but like, we're not going around to correct people, right? What we're ultimately doing is we're building relationships, we're building trust, we're getting information that we can use so that everything that we do as instructional leaders is better informed because we're in classrooms, right? There's so much that we can't see from the office. There's so much that doesn't come to us in reports or data or email or assessment results or district communications. Like, there's so much that we just have to see for ourselves by being in classrooms. So holistically, I hope that's the big picture impact of this work of getting into classrooms. It's not just that you give helpful feedback and advice to teachers, although that does happen. It's really your own decision making and your professional relationships that benefit. And in chapter 18, we talk a little bit more about relational trust. I quote, I think, Brick and Schneider on some benefits of relational trust. And a lot of those are especially relevant around change, right? If you ask people to change and you haven't been in classrooms, you don't really know what they're doing, they know you don't really know what they're doing, people are going to have very strong feelings about being asked to do something different if they know that what they're currently doing is not well known to their leaders. So see this as an investment in the ability to lead change. Your time in classrooms gives you the credibility, it gives you the information, and it just positions you in a much stronger place to be able to ask people to change, because they know that you know what they're up to currently and where people's skills are currently, and really creates that that shared sense of above and beyond and working as a team when we're building that relational trust. And this theory of action, you'll actually see this on our website. You'll see it in my email sometimes. I believe it fits together like this. This kind of organizes everything we do at the Principal Center about getting into classrooms every day so you can have those feedback conversations with teachers, individually change people's practice, but ultimately learn where your big opportunities lie as an organization. Things like initiatives, curriculum changes, professional development, instructional frameworks, developing your own frameworks. Those kinds of big picture decisions, I think, are where the real leverage is. And I'll just say from my personal experience, I don't think any particular piece of advice I ever gave someone in a feedback conversation rocked their world. I hope I gave them some helpful feedback, but I think ultimately this comes down to trust and decision making and school improvement planning. I think that's where the big impact is. And then I had a note in this chapter about qualitative data. You know, often when we're looking at assessments, we're looking at quantitative data. You know, what percentage of students met standard, and what were our pass rates in different demographic groups, and so on. When you're getting into classrooms, I think we have to be careful about the term data, because that can make us think of numbers. But really, what we're getting when we get into classrooms is trends, right? It's a sense of where people's practice is. It's, you know, hopefully translatable into some sort of data, like, you know, your teacher evaluation ratings become data eventually. But we're really looking for kind of where people are. What's the readiness? What are the needs? What are the gaps? What are the strengths? That's the kind of thing that we get by being in classrooms that we can never get from test scores and other types of data. And that, of course, is useful in those decisional roles that we play. So like I said, we're going to move quickly through these next couple of chapters, but I'd like to invite you to reflect on the decisional roles that you play. What do you make decisions about? Certainly teacher evaluation, maybe some school improvement planning, budget. Think about your particular role. What decisional roles do you need good information for? And what are you discovering as you get into classrooms, as you look beyond the quantitative data and start to kind of get a sense of where people are and what the patterns are? So I'd love to have your reflections in the chat. We will keep moving just in the interest of time as we go through these chapters to see how it all fits together. Chapter 19 is about different models of professional learning. And again, we'll hit these very briefly here. I think your writing is an underutilized way of drawing on what you're seeing in classrooms. And if you've been through any of our materials lately on the Repertoire app, you'll know that we've added a writing tool that's not for observations. It's actually for emails, newsletter articles, things like that. So there's the Repertoire Content Creator Documents tool that can help you celebrate practice in your staff newsletter, your emails that you're sending to staff, things like that. So certainly your own written noticing to your whole staff of what you're seeing in classrooms is valuable. Using video, lots of good ways out there to use video or get people looking at each other's practice through instructional rounds or get people into classrooms, get yourself into different classrooms by shadowing a student. I'm curious if anyone has ever done student shadowing, because this is a different strategy where instead of just going to classrooms that you pick a kid and you follow that kid. You know, obviously you tell them what you're doing or else they're going to have some questions for you. Heather, have you ever done that?
I have not actually. I've been privy to it in a middle school setting where a VP followed a middle school child around, and it was related to anxiety and some mental health concerns on the part of the student. And so a little bit different reason, not necessarily student achievement in that case, but the student wasn't achieving and wasn't wanting to come to school. And so the vice principal followed him around for the day. So an interesting strategy. I'd be interested to know if anybody else has done that either.
Yeah, I think that's especially valuable for, for considering groups that are easy to forget that they have particular needs. Like if you have an ELL population, well, they probably have a very different experience of school than many other students do. So shadowing a student, with a particular situation in mind, what is it like to not really be super proficient in English? If I was not proficient in English, what would I be feeling? What would I be experiencing in this particular class right now? Are the directions clear? Do I understand what I'm supposed to do in this activity? Things like that can just give you an entirely different perspective. And there are some resources in this chapter if you want to learn more about student shadowing. I can't say I've done it on a formal basis, and again, Heather, I think kind of like the principle you described, sometimes you show up in classes where a particular student is just to learn more about that student. But a great strategy here. Eric says, let's see, teachers' use of content PLC and interdisciplinary PLCs. Yeah, observations of PLCs have allowed my team to identify our priorities with this work. This has informed our need for a focus on specific resources and supports that might be needed. Yeah, so sometimes the direct evidence that we need may be of, Eric, am I understanding you're saying visiting PLC meetings, not just lessons where there's one teacher with the students, but actually visiting the meetings where teachers are collaborating can give you important evidence about school improvement priorities. Let me know if I'm not getting that right there. In terms of a few ways to celebrate, yeah, good deal. Thank you, Eric. Again, I want to urge you to consider your writing as a key opportunity to reinforce the good things that you're seeing, to find ways to celebrate and get more of what's working. So don't be afraid to use the written word. It may not be the most comfortable. I'm happy to help with that. I'm happy to put templates and repertoire that can help you celebrate things in writing. A good tool for sending out a newsletter to your staff or families is S'more. There are lots of other things like that. I know people use different tools, but if you don't have a regular, I would say if you don't have a weekly channel to communicate your leadership thoughts to your community, it's worth establishing one and really giving yourself that bandwidth to be able to communicate. And then one further idea that we will have more to say about next year is developing your own instructional frameworks. So Heather and I are in the final stages of revisions now. We got the green light from our reviewers, and Solution Tree will be publishing this probably early in the new year, I'm guessing. To help you develop your own frameworks, which I think is kind of the logical extension of a lot of what we've been talking about here. So keep an eye out for that. Susan says, yes, I've shadowed students to learn more from their perspective in regards to instruction, schedule, transitions, student relations, et cetera. Great experience. Susan, that is fabulous. We may have to talk more about sometime. And what you learned from that and how you set that up. I think Marjorie Ginsburg has a good book on that I reference in the bibliography if you're interested in more on that. So when you get into classrooms, be thinking about how you can get other people into classrooms personally or indirectly or virtually or vicariously through your learning. I think the more we can deprivatize practice and share what's going on and not make our classrooms silos, the better off we will be. Just a couple of real quick thoughts. For the last couple of chapters here. In chapter 20, we talk about choosing a focus for an observation cycle. And as Heather mentioned earlier, we don't recommend that you do that early on. We recommend that you just get in the classrooms, you know, notice what's going on. And maybe in that third cycle and beyond, it's worth choosing a focus. But you want that focus to be something that you actually have a good chance of seeing, right? You don't want to get into a classroom and say, I'm looking for X, and then have X be something that doesn't happen that often because you're just going to be frustrated, right? So it has to be something that happens a lot, something that's observable, something that's relevant, something that's going to make a difference. And you want it to, you know, to kind of cover a lot of classrooms, right? You don't want to say, I want to see this month, I'm looking for science experiments. Well, probably most of your teachers aren't science teachers. You want to choose something that's going to be relevant to most teachers most of the time. And sometimes you will find that you can't include every single subject. Like sometimes PE or art are just a difficult fit for certain observation focuses. And I think they kind of get that and they're okay with that. But for the most part, we want to be able to to base our observation cycle focus on something that we're going to be able to see in a lot of classrooms and have some evidence that we can talk about, use that evidence to get teachers involved in a feedback conversation. We want to make sure that we're not focusing too much on a surface feature where people can just say, oh yeah, Justin wants to see questioning strategies. So when Justin shows up in my classroom, I'm going to be sure to ask really good questions. Like, okay, well, do something, we want it to lead to a good conversation, not just be people jumping through hoops to show us what we want to see. And then we want to make sure it aligns with some sort of strategic goal as well. So that is it for chapter 20. And then in chapter 21, just a few more thoughts on extending this work across your school or district. If you are the only person getting into classrooms on your admin team, that can be a little tricky. I would be happy to chat more about that. There are some things we can do to get everybody on the same page, especially if you've encountered resistance. If you're not the principal and you've encountered resistance from the principal, please feel free to reach out to me and we can strategize a little bit individually. I know we've already done that in some cases, but happy to chat more. We want your whole admin team to be in classrooms. We know different people on a team have different roles and responsibilities, and that can make it difficult. But I think working together, covering for each other, to get into classrooms can be incredibly valuable within your school, but also across the district. So if your school is the only school where people are getting into classrooms very much, don't be afraid to spread the word and say, hey, we're finding great results from doing this. And I'm happy to chat about how we might be able to support you in getting other schools to get into classrooms. Visit each other's schools. You've probably been on learning walks or instructional rounds and things like that. And some of those models are described in, I think it's chapter 3 of the book. So if you didn't hear us talk about chapter 3, where we talk about different instructional rounds models, all of these overlap in some way, but the common theme is let's get into classrooms, let's pay attention to what's going on, and let's use that information to become better informed leaders and to have stronger relationships. So that brings us to the end, to the epilogue, and my admonishment to you is to just keep it up, even if you haven't really been able to get into classrooms much. I know this has been an exceptionally difficult year, but as soon as you're able to get into classrooms and make that the foundation for everything that you do, because the more you learn, the better your relationships are with teachers from being in the classrooms, the more effective a leader you will be. We're trying to get ourselves on track here to be in classrooms 500 times a year. Heather, is that realistic? Can people get into classrooms 500 times a year? I don't know. What do you think about that?
Absolutely, Justin. They absolutely can. I thought you were crazy when you first said that, but they absolutely can. It was about 3 a day. So you can do that. It's very doable. And those brief conversations afterwards, I would still be working at that piece. I am having this school year, having brief conversations with everybody. For the last couple of pre-pandemic school years, I was maybe having 2 emails and 1 face-to-face conversation. I modified it for myself to make sure I was actually having those at least interactions, not always face-to-face. So Yeah, you're getting into each, you know, if you have about 30 people on your staff, you're getting into each class about 18 times a year. And like we talked about earlier on, you know, a consistent rotation, so you're not always going to your friends or, you know, where things are going great, or to the daycare where it's always just really nice. You want to make sure that you're consistent and clustering by some sort of team or department or grade or the physical location in the school, something that makes it easy to get into those three classrooms on a consistent rotation. Absolutely possible.
Yeah. I guess I'll say also, you know, this is a model, right? This is based on what is, you know, in the broad strokes going to work for the most people. There's no typical school, right? Every school has, you know, different kind of strange features that make this challenging in different ways. Like if you have portables, it's hard to get to portables. It really is. If you are covering classes right now, it's hard to get into classrooms. So please don't feel like if you can't hit every element of this perfectly right now, that you shouldn't try. So by all means, you know, and in some cases, you know, you'll have other things that you're expected to do as far as walkthroughs that, you know, maybe I said not to do in chapter two or something like that. So I'm absolutely happy to chat about any challenges around the edges of what we've talked about. But I really believe that, you know, that done is better than perfect. You know, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Don't let a, you know, and especially when it comes to your feedback, don't let this desire to give really, really good feedback keep you from getting into classrooms. And I will be the first to tell you, I often found myself just thinking, wow, this is great. What I'm seeing today is great. And I might enjoy chatting about it with the teacher, but it is a myth that we're always going to have just earth-shattering feedback for every single teacher. Don't let that keep you from getting into classrooms, paying attention, and just being a presence. Eric says, what I really like about this model is that it sets the expectation for visibility by administration throughout the building. And Eric sends his apologies, is not able to come on webcam tonight. It has a really positive impact on my leadership and the relationships that I have with my faculty, students, and families. And Eric is a newly appointed middle school principal, just recently moved up from AP in a different school to a middle school principalship, and is hitting the ground running, getting into classrooms, building those relationships. Yeah, and really, like, the visibility that you get and the relationships that you get from being in classrooms, often, like, you're shaving years off of that relationship building curve, right? Like, it would take the average administrator 10 years to get into classrooms as much as you will have been in classrooms by like Thanksgiving, Eric, right? I mean, seriously, most people are in each teacher's classroom about once or twice a year. And if you've been in each teacher's classroom like 10, 12 times by the middle of the year, you are miles and miles and miles ahead. So kudos to you for committing to this work, engaging in this work, and keep at it, right? This is going to be a year full of challenges. This is going to be a year when nothing really works as it's supposed to. And I know we're still dealing with a lot of challenging staffing issues, bus drivers, and, you know, we're having all kinds of vaccine mandates that are causing people to quit, and, you know, just staffing challenges. So please give yourself extra grace and extra patience, and, you know, give yourself a homework extension on this. There are no late penalties for getting started with any of this. So please do what you can, and don't feel bad if you're not able to do more. But I think any efforts to get into classrooms are going to be richly rewarding. So please reach out to us at any time if you'd like to strategize or chat or get set up with repertoire. I will, again, we didn't talk about the note cards today, but the note cards are available to you if you would like to use those note cards to get into classrooms. And if you didn't hear me say this before, I'm pretty sure I've offered, we actually have a link where members can request the note cards. Like, don't tweet this link because it costs us a lot of money to send them out. But for you, we will physically send you the note cards already printed and cut. As many as you need, just fill out that form, let us know how many you need, and we'll mail them to you, or you can print your own from the template on our website. But use that tool to get yourself into classrooms. It just makes a huge difference. And Heather, like, you're cutting out the framework. Sometimes just having a physical tool, I think, is so powerful.
Absolutely.
So that is it. We are at the end of our time. Thank you so much for engaging with us over these past 4 weeks. We're not going anywhere. We will be, I think what we're going to do next Sunday is we're going to start switching back to Ascend Live. I'm very excited to talk about the Ed Leadership job search, and we may mix in some non-job search topics here on Sunday night, but very excited to start the week with you. I know many of you are going to be looking for new positions next year, but it's not too soon. You might think, geez, school just started. Why are we going to be talking about the job search? It's never really too soon to be preparing because really the best preparation is good professional experience. And that's what you're building right now. So we'll get back at Ascend Live pretty soon. Have a great week. Heather, thank you so much for presenting with me. This has been a blast.
It's lots of fun. Thanks for having me.
Really appreciate the opportunity to work with you on this. All right, everyone, have a wonderful week, and we'll be in touch. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.